Well, sort of taking on where Robin Lever left off in one sense of the word, we have contemporaries, Bach and Graupner, but also in one sense of the word, colleagues, brothers, in another sense of the word. There was certainly at least a respect for one another, and in the process of the competition for the job and for the position in Leipzig, there is even in Graupner's letter of declining the position, he even recommends Bach. I personally think the letter came too late to have it really play a particular role in Bach getting the position. But nonetheless, at least there is that word in there that Graupner, although he was a person who received the position, so to say, the offer of the position ahead of Bach, certainly Graupner respected Bach, and although Graupner was in one of the different parties, if you will, certainly there was a very solid respect there. I can't underestimate what Robin Lever said about these articles in the Bach yearbook. Anybody that reads German, Ulrich Ziegele, it's about 2 years ago, there was the first chapter. It's beautiful reading, beautiful writing. And I think it was last year was the second, I don't know when the third and final part. Well, at any rate, our time will obviously be far too short, because especially if I would just chat about the relationship of Graupner with St. Thomas. And of course, there would be a lot to say there, because he was a St. Thomas choir boy, and a number of other things as well. Now, Christoph Graupner was well known in his day. This is a fact. But why, then, has he remained a mere name in music history books, and really little more? At the outset, allow me to give four possible reasons for your consideration. First of all, during the 60 years after the composer's death, that's from 1760 until 1819, the court at Darmstadt, where Graupner served for 50 years, denied his heirs their due payment for the further use of the music manuscripts and hindered performances outside the court, as well as any publication. So, of course, by the time anyone would have been interested in publishing or propagating Graupner's cantatas and works, the music was long since out of date, so to say. I mean, we're hearing Schubert symphonies and all sorts of things. Yes. Why? Oh, why? Oh, they were greedy. That's very simple. The court, they had a solid system of music making through Graupner, and whether it was chamber music or cantatas or whatever it all was, it worked for them in a very uncomplicated way, high quality. And so when Graupner died, they kept on reusing his works. And actually, as it was the custom at the time, they should have, that music was actually the property of the heirs. And so there was this quarrel, not a quarrel, really. The court just said, you're not going to get them, or whatever. They just marched off with them and didn't care when they brought them back, and so on and so forth. And so, in other words, research on Graupner has been sporadic and is still incomplete. Consequently, the bass solo cantatas, which was the subject of my own dissertation, until now has not been dealt with seriously in any way, and certainly there have not been practical performing editions. There is one volume in the Denkmäler Deutsche Tonkunst series that has 17 cantatas, more of a study edition version, certainly not for practical performance. So that would be my first sort of reason for consideration. Another reason, a possible reason, during his lifetime, Graupner did not make copies for sale, like many contemporaries, but even willed that his works be burned upon his death. Now, maybe he foresaw the quarrel with the heirs and so on, but there were other composers that did that too. And I think this even, this is strictly my own view, but it seems to me like there's a possibility that the reason those composers wanted to do that sort of thing was that they really felt that this was something that they did at the moment before God, and now that's the end of it. So, yeah, then it's someone else's turn, you know, sort of. Well, obviously, his wish wasn't fulfilled. And thirdly, the music is truly chamber music, which by nature, especially in our day and in the 19th century especially, is not usually as popular as some other genres, like, say, Handel's Messiah, you know, large-scale works, or the Elijah, or even works like Bach Cantata 80 or something like that. I mean, this is big music. And here the Grautner things, as you heard last night, although we could sing it with a choir of 60-plus, this is really chamber music. It obviously was conceived to be sung by a few voices. And this here's part of sort of the vision behind why I got involved in this, was not that we could, you know, sing it with a nice choir that we did last evening. And by the way, you sang beautifully. I was very, very pleased indeed. It was just gorgeous. And as I've shared with some of you, if I could have this kind of a choir at my disposal, I think I'd probably go back into conducting, you know, really. Well, whatever. A fourth possible reason, and this is not to set Grautner apart from everyone else, but it does contribute to the fact that he, so to say, has never gotten off the ground, is that the texts, although they are good poetry, they are devotional, personal devotional material, really, which actually limits those texts then to persons who are interested in these Christian implications. You see this with the Bach. You hear it again and again from Robin Lieber. You know, I mean, people, even people that are supposed to be interested, you know, they scratch their head and they say, well, what is that? You know, beautiful music, but the text, what's that? You know? So here with Grautner, there is more of a consistent style, as I'll be telling, explaining in a moment, because he had essentially two text writers for all of his hundreds and hundreds of cantatas. Okay, the second section of what I would like to consider here would be why bother, you could put it in colloquial terms. Why bother? The cantatas of Christoph Grautner, and especially his solo cantatas, deserve our attention for several reasons. Now, the first that I would propose is he is one of several Bach contemporaries who, in the shadow of the great master, has been neglected to a degree and also misunderstood. And because the general understanding and impression of Bach's contemporaries is somewhat unclear, inadvertently the prevailing view of Bach is not entirely correct. In other words, if the context in which, the setting in which a composer has worked is not entirely clear and understood, then in this case Bach, the picture of Bach cannot be, as accurately dealt with, because otherwise you're working a little bit in a vacuum. So I personally am encouraging very much the dealing with the Bach contemporaries, because we can then thereby gain important insight into Bach's world. Now, in the meager information that is readily accessible about Grautner, inaccuracies abound. We're talking about a meager amount of information and then an incredible number of inaccuracies. I need only to refer you to the short paragraph in the new concise Oxford Dictionary of Music, 1985, Michael Kennedy, which has, in this one short paragraph, four glaring errors. Even the place of birth is wrong. In the main Oxford Dictionary of 1985, it's only partially wrong. At least it has the place of birth correct. Okay, so, and also, by the way, the New Groves Dictionary was a wonderful dictionary, but the chap that wrote the article on Grautner comes almost entirely from the world of opera. And so he deals almost entirely with Grautner's operas. They are, they obviously won him some fame, but it was the operas were by far not the crown of his creative efforts. The second why bother consideration is that as a source of consistently fine quality solo cantatas and also choir cantatas like the one we sang yesterday evening of moderate difficulty, Grautner is a worthy discovery. In the solo cantatas, he wrote 47 church solo cantatas for soprano, 47 for bass, and a large number for duet combinations and trios. These solo cantatas, or solo cantatas for solo voices, represent about one-tenth of all his cantatas. He wrote, as I had said here a few days ago, over 1,400 cantatas. So he actually, for many years, wrote a new cantata year in, year out, every other week, and then for quite a number of years, a cantata every single Sunday of the year, and more. And that's not all the music he wrote. He wrote chamber music by the pound. Nothing about British, but you know, by weight. Okay. This, do you want to tell me that the pound weighs something nowadays? No. Now, this source of cantatas is valuable for the voice student. Not everyone can deal appropriately with a Bach solo cantata, or have you ever tried singing one? Whereas these Grautner solo cantatas are definitely a possibility. For the concert singer, that is for the mature sort of professional singer, as you could also hear last night, the music is a pleasure and challenge to sing, because these fine soloists, these soprano and bass and so on, I mean, they really had a challenge. But even more importantly for our considerations, it is a liturgically valuable source. The theology is thoroughly orthodox, and as literature, they are much more accessible for the late 20th century user than are the many Baroque cantatas by whichever composer, which are plagued with things difficult for us to understand. Now, for a few cantatas, Grautner shared one of his text writers with Bach, Georg Christian Lehms, L-E-H-M-S. By the way, there were, I think, Bach used 10 of Lehms' texts. But it has been observed rightfully that Bach would probably have been happy and thankful to have had Grautner's primary text writer, Grautner's good friend and brother-in-law, Johann Conrad Lichtenberg, L-I-C-H-T-E-N-B-E-R-G, Lichtenberg, the father of the famous German literary figure. This would, of course, assume a lot of things, amongst others, that Bach wouldn't have wanted to deliberately struggle with his text. But I think really, as you would approach Grautner more closely, you would see that Grautner worked intimately with both of his main text writers, and where he had this unity theologically, from a literary point of view, and so on, it inspired Grautner, certainly. There was an interaction, although the poets were poets in their own right, and in a very short period where Grautner did not have a regular text writer, he was scrambling practically like Bach was, and he was sneaking in texts from one source or another. Now, Grautner and Lichtenberg worked as a team for about 35 years, and the only text set by Grautner during that time were the Leipzig competition cantatas. I'll say more about those in just a moment. And one peripheral text by Uffenbach in 1728, and that was a cantata sort of thanks because Uffenbach supported Grautner in the printing and production of the Darmstadt chorale book of 1728. The third reason, Grautner is a source of a number of original written-out vocal improvisations. And the appraising and dealing with these examples requires some care, but they do present some some usable practical examples. In other words, we can see from those examples what the performance practice was like, especially in the repetition of the opening section of a da capo aria. Fourthly, although Graupner never could, so to say, dethrone Bach as king of church music, if you will, he is an important and refreshing option, especially in this area of the grade of difficulty. Now, Christoph Graupner, born 1683, 2 years earlier than Bach, lived until 1760, 10 years after Bach, was one of the most highly regarded contemporaries of Johann Sebastian Bach, and together with Telemann, Kaiser, Händel, Heinichen, and Fasch, had a more prestigious reputation than the now-famed master. And as Kapellmeister of the court at Darmstadt, Germany, for 50 years, Graupner made a worthy contribution to church music with his over 1,400 church cantatas, as well as with his Darmstädter Choralbuch of 1728. He was born in Kirchberg near Zwickau in the Erzgebirge. What do we call that in English? I forget now. Never mind, it's Erzgebirge. Yeah. Young Christoph began keyboard studies with a local organist, and in 1696, age 13, he became choir boy at the St. Thomas Church in Leipzig. And the cantor, Johann Schelle, who showed special interest in the talented boy and gave him additional training at the keyboard and in singing, seemed to be a particular delight. And together with Heinichen, he also studied with Johann Kuhnau, Schelle's successor, and soon became his copyist. And it seems that Graupner learned a lot about composition through this copyist activities for the St. Thomas cantor Kuhnau. Beginning in 1703, Graupner studied law at the University of Leipzig, but when Swedish troops invaded Saxony in 1706, the young musician went to Hamburg. As a recognized keyboard virtuoso, he soon let himself, quote, be persuaded, as he writes, to become harpsichordist in the Hamburg opera at the Gänsemarkt. Goose Market, still standing there today. Not the opera, but whatever. The Goose Market is a streetcar stop. You know. Here at the first opera house of note, the first German opera house of note, Graupner had the opportunity to gather 3 years of experience as an opera composer. He was not pleased with life at the opera, and as he wrote in his autobiography, in Matheson's Grundlage einer Ehrenpforte, after a while, I longed to get away on account of the unpleasant occurrences accompanying the work. And soon my longings were satisfied, end of quote. He gladly accepted the invitation of Count Ernst Ludwig of Hessen-Darmstadt, who was an opera enthusiast, to become the Weisskapellmeister, or the sort of second associate Kapellmeister, I guess you could call it, at his court in 1709. In 1711, Graupner already moved up, just 2 years later, moved up to Kapellmeister after the retirement of Wolfgang Karl Briegel, who's been mentioned here already, who had established a fine musical reputation for the court. And Graupner was to build up the opera and compose for the court chapel services. Those were his main duties. The composer's ability, diligence, and fame brought music life in Darmstadt to a very high level of recognition, and a number of excellent artists were attracted to the court. Telemann thought it to be a valuable recommendation for one of his serenades that before it was known, quote, the work had been honored by being played by the unparalleled Darmstadt Orchestra. This was a contemporary quote. The well-known Hamburg operatic bass and composer, Gottfried Grunewald, came in 1712, just a couple of years later, and remained at the court until his death as singer and as Graupner's Weisskapellmeister, second Kapellmeister. Others who followed were Johann Friedrich Fasch, whose name was mentioned a few minutes ago, as one of those offered the position in St. Thomas before Bach. Fasch came in 1713 to study composition with both Grunewald and Graubner. And then also the writer Georg Christian Lehms, who became court poet. It was absolutely an attraction. I mean, that's the vivacious life of the court there. And even after financial difficulties forced a closing of the opera and a general reduction of the musical establishment in 1719, a small but extremely capable group of musicians was retained. Now, Graubner's excellent reputation led him to be elected by the City Council of Leipzig in 1723 to the office of Thomas Cantor. And he wanted to go, but remained in Darmstadt at the demand of the court. Pardon me, the count, at the court. There would be a lot to say about this, that he was given a substantial pay raise, but he didn't get paid very often. There's a small problem there with that argument. But for, at any rate, let's see, let's move on here. In the course of the Leipzig competition, Graupner composed two and possibly three cantatas, Auf der Tiefen rufen wir, which we are to be singing next Friday, and Lobe den Herrn aller Heiden, which Robin Lieber mentioned, both for the second Sunday of Epiphany, 1723, both for large vocal and instrumental forces, something somewhat unusual in comparison to his usual chamber cantatas for the court chapel in Darmstadt. Further, both of these cantatas have texts which cannot be compared with the literary quality of Graupner's Darmstadt texts by Lehms and Lichtenberg, and which can be compared with Bach's competition cantata texts in various ways, the Bach 22 and 23. So in other words, these men were given texts, essentially, which seems to be the case. Graupner appropriately adapted his compositions to the demands of the Leipzig performing situation in a number of ways, as did Bach, including the instrumental doubling of choral voices, in particular the boys' voices, something that was that hardly would have been necessary for the mature adult voices with which he worked in Darmstadt, as well as the excellent chamber acoustics in the court chapel. I mean, one on a part or two or so, I mean, this would be plenty in a room the size of the court chapel. The composer also wrote a third composition during this time, a Magnificat, and you see that on the screen here, the opening page. We only have the full score in existence now and not the parts. With most of Graupner's cantatas, we have the really very clear full score, but we also have all the parts, or what seem to be all the parts, and a very consistent number of parts, so that we have a quite a clear picture as to how many musicians were used. So this was a Magnificat. Now, there is no record that this was ever performed in Leipzig, and it was also written on Darmstadt paper, in contrast to the two competition cantatas previously mentioned, which were, of course, on Leipzig paper. At the same time, though, the Magnificat is the only cantata from among the over 1,400 with a Latin text. Unlike in Darmstadt, the Latin Magnificat, the Nunc Dimittis, and the Ordinary of the Mass were still a part of the Leipzig liturgical tradition. Now, so in addition, the writing of complete fugues in this and the other two cantatas is somewhat of an exception to his usual Darmstadt style, which normally included merely fugato sections, as I have mentioned in the rehearsals. Now, I have edited all three of his competition cantatas, if you want to count the Magnificat as a bona fide competition cantata. Two of them are in print, the Magnificat and, of course, the Auf der Tiefen that we're singing this week. The vivacious Lobe den Herrn aller Heiden is sitting somewhere in Hensler Verlag. But whatever. But I think you will notice as you start performing this that it's well-crafted music. It's good. For my personal taste, I will take the cantata from last evening so far as the style, the text, and so on. During the next quarter of a century, that is roughly the second quarter of the 18th century, the composer completed several important compositional projects. The first is the Darmstädtisches Choralbuch of 1728, which Grautner himself etched in copper. Let me just give you the... Not a very good reproduction for our purposes here, but you notice all sorts of little sort of symbols and extra little words put in here and there. Over here we have the, this is the face actually of the count, you know, see those little unmistakable figures there. And of course the Count's Ludwig, the DL up here, this is the coat of arms, the head of the star on it. Here's the title page. And here's an actual example of this is the first actual page. So this is the way this choralbuch. You are clear with the difference between a choralbuch and a hymn book, right? I mean, a choralbuch was the one used by the organ. Not have all the techniques in it usually, but have the, you know, the title of the, or the name of the tune or the whatever, and then it would have to have the soprano, in other words, the melody, and then the bass line, or the basso continuo, and then the organist would, of course, fill in the inner parts.
Have you heard that this is a different chorale book of the early 18th century, apart from the start of writing?
Now, until the death of Grautner's good friend and Vizekapellmeister Gottfried Grunewald in 1739, Grautner had been composing cantatas alternately with him for the afternoon services at the court chapel. After Grunewald's death, he had to write a cantata every single week. And at this time, when one rightfully would await less care and interest, he composed two special cycles of Passiontide cantatas, 1741 and 1743. Grautner never wrote anything like a full Passion setting, like St. John and St. Matthew Passion of Bach, but always had as a sort of an unfulfilled dream to write a cycle of Passiontide cantatas, and he indeed did do both, and in 1741 and 1743, of special interest, especially in the first one, unusual instrumentation. This is 10 cantatas in the first one, which were performed mostly on the Sundays through Lent. Of course, there's more than enough there, and I won't go into that now, but according to the theme or the gospel theme that he was commenting on in the cantata, that is Lichtenberg, actually, of course, the text writer, Grautner then used unusual instruments. he used the as the text is commenting on the Passion story, the composer includes the violetta, the charlemont, which is the predecessor to the clarinet, and then various times the oboe d'amore, and even uses the violetta more than one, and so on. And then the 1743 cycle of seven cantatas, the texts relate to the seven last words of Christ on the cross. In other words, a cantata for each word of Christ on the cross. And there in that one, it seems that he employed those cantatas more during Holy Week rather than the seven Sundays preceding Easter. But here again, he does not use the straight biblical narrative, but rather comments on it. Now, Graupner's compositions are generally melodious, imaginative, and of true artistic content, and his style points toward the simple beauty of the classic, the Viennese classic, rather than further expanding Baroque forms and techniques. The instrumental sound of Graupner's cantata, as a rule, is based on a four-part string accompaniment. According to need and opportunity, he included other instruments, and he showed not only that he was well-informed about the latest and most interesting trends of the time, but that he himself was a leader in the development of new styles and techniques. Richard Crocker writes that the German composer who achieved the most happy combination of Italian style with German taste in sacred music was Christoph Graupner. Again and again, he was able to employ relatively unusual instruments in his cantatas with a noteworthy sense for the timbres, the violetta, the viola d'amore, the corno di selva, the charlemont, bassoon as solo instrument, the oboe d'amore, or in his final cantata of 1754, two clarinets. But whether for voice or instrument, he writes idiomatically. That is, his compositional technique takes into consideration the unique characteristics and qualities of the particular voice or instruments and arrives at a good sing and play ability. Now, a remarkable element in his style was the retention of the chorale as the basis for his sacred cantatas. This is not self-understood, and it was certainly not inflicted upon him. In spite of his progressive compositional style for the time, Graupner, along with J.S. Bach, was one of the only leading composers of the time that consistently retained the chorale as a regular and important element in his cantata compositions. The simple four-part isometric form of the chorale, where the instruments double the voice parts, is almost never to be found, though, in his cantatas. Remember, he did not have to keep the singing abilities of a city church congregation in mind, like in Leipzig, during the court chapel's services, as did Bach, of course, in Leipzig. While you may have some Bach chorale settings in mind, allow me to show you a few examples of the chorale in some of Graupner's cantatas. Now, except in a few scattered early cantatas and those from the year 1720, after a major cutback in nearly everything at the court due to war debts, Graupner, of course, it has nothing to do with the chorale, but they were sort of experimenting during that 1 year, Graupner always included the chorale, so you could say, roughly 1,300 or whatever cantatas have the chorale in it, okay? Now, here are some examples of the use of the chorale. I will just show them to you, the lack of time here. The one would be from last evening, from the solo cantata. You see the I'll come back and talk about this particular example. this would not be the kind of thing for us to have in a final chorale in a Boston opera. This one, I really appreciate. This is, of course, not Grouse's original. I just have written this one out. This is from around 1740 or so. From a just barely passed line at a Christmas concert, about third Christmas or so. This is a Graupner chorale melody. He did write a few that remained in some hymn books for quite some time. An extraordinary tune, but it's extraordinary because of the rhythm that Graupner puts onto it, but then with the accompaniment, it's just incredible. Let me sing you first the melody as you would have it in a chorale book, as it was in the 1728 chorale book, you know. Vom vielen, vom alle lernt Jesu erkennen. And so on. Now here he has it. Kommt vielen, kommt alle lernt Jesu erkennen. Instrumental part. Can you sit down and just, yeah, you can. Absolutely. Very, very joyful. Here is an example from his last solo cantata for bass, 1750, the year that Bach died. This is for the third of Christmas. Here you see the very old with the very new. The very old is the Nun freut euch alle Christen gemein und lasst uns fröhlich springen, which is sort of a second melody to Luther's. And but then when you look at the accompaniment, you know, with all these finely dotted kinds of rhythms that were prevalent in the very late Baroque and going into the Viennese classic and the pre-classic and so on. So you have the very old. Yeah, the continuo doubles the voice part. Here you can hear it. Yes, it makes a very bold sound. It makes the chorale come out incredibly strong. So the continuum, and you see a figure here or there, but it's almost questionable as to how much the person would have done sort of sketching it in, really, because you have the real activity in the voice part and in the top. Now, Graupner, as I said before, had two primary text writers, and in spite of the rapidly spinning clock here, I'm going to spend just a couple of minutes on these two text writers, because one of them is one of Bach's text writers, too. And here is one of his texts. Finish it out yourself, because you know what the first stanza of the hymn is, don't you? You know, in other words, that's a given. And so he only gives you just sort of a lead in to that, but then of course writes out the recitative, the aria with the da capo indication, the recitative, and the final aria with the da capo indication. Now this is from 17, but he wrote the text in 1711, 1712. Is when the cantata was written, and I do want to emphasize the fact that this was this Reformed cantata, and this is a Reformed cantata, that this was a really quite a new thing, and that Lames already at this very early date seems to be quite comfortable, quite solid in this style, which is really remarkable. Now, the text writer of Lassungs in deiner Liebe from last evening is Georg Christian Lehms, who earned himself special recognition among his German contemporaries for his sincere cantata texts based on biblical and chorale sources, for his unique biblical poetry that is based on poetry based on biblical stories. And if we had a lot of time, I could tell you some astonishingly fine things about Lehms here. He had an unbelievable sense for, let's say, he had a sense for common sense in the scripture. And so when he writes, for example, his book on, so to say, the love stories in the Bible, you're thinking, what is that going to be now, you know? And no, it is absolutely beautiful, and it is so intact. It is so full of solid theological teaching. I highly recommend that if you're interested in those early documents. The title is something like Heldenliebe, that's out in the Neuen Testament, or some such title. Then also he wrote a very interesting lexicon of German poetesses and their works. Deutschlands galante Poetinnen mit ihren sinnreichen und netten Proben, 1715. Between 1710 and 17, he wrote at least 194 cantata texts, some of which were not only set to music by Graupner and Grunewald, but also by Johann Sebastian Bach. Lehms was influenced by Erdmann Neumeister and the Reformed style of text writing, which mixed the elements of the biblical concerto, the chorale, and the song-like poetry with the musical forms of the Italian chamber cantata and the Neapolitan opera. The most obvious of these newer elements are the operatic recitative, the da capo aria, and the appearance of a newly formed madrigal-like poetry. And the text of the bass solo cantata, Lassungs in deiner Liebe, is taken from Lehms' cantata text book from the year 1711, and here, as I said, he already seems to be secure in this new style of writing. And now, just for a moment, something about the text writer of the Also hat Gott die Welt geliebt, and you're going to say with the Apostle John, but this is the cantata, the full cantata text. This would be Lichtenberg. This was Graupner's brother-in-law and pastor, who was also the father of the famous satirist and Göttingen physics professor, Georg Christoph Lichtenberg. And his immediate examples in cantata text writing were Neumeister and, of course, Lehms. After the death of Lehms in 1717, a new court librarian, Heinrich Walter Gerdes, temporarily wrote and collected cantata texts, but already during this time, Graupner sort of snuck in some texts by Lichtenberg. And as the court sought to find a text writer in 1718 and 1719, Lichtenberg was willing to fill the need temporarily. He, however, remained the text writer until 1743, at which time increased pastoral duties prevented him from continuing. And during those years, 1719 to 1743, Lichtenberg wrote over 1,600 sacred cantata texts for Graupner and Grunewald. And in 1743, as he gave up the writing of the cantata text yearbooks, he felt that, quote, "My poetic fire is diminishing, for otherwise I wrote 6 to 8 cantata texts in a day, and once I even wrote 12 in one day. Now it hardly comes up to 4 cantatas." Now here we can see what an enormous creative urge drove him on. And if you look at the care, the symbolism, the biblical tapestry that is before you, you think it is not possible. I don't care if you have a month to write one, but to write half a dozen or so in a day and to be frustrated that you could write so few. And his writings are indeed reckoned among Germany's finest cantata texts of the time, and in their sincerity and practicality, they reveal spinning here, but Lichtenberg was he was a city superintendent. He was in his piety, he had a fervent faith, a piety. When he became city superintendent of the Darmstadt area, the pietists were terribly upset that such a liberal, godless man would be put into this office, you know. Whereas in reality, I mean, he was very, very conservative, and so, well, whatever. So, let me move on now very quickly to a couple of moments here with the actual cantata from yesterday evening, and here I will just give you a couple of hints because the time is essentially gone. This is an example of how Graupner took the opening melody of this chorale, Herr Christe, einig Gott Sohn, Herr Christe, einig Gott Sohn, and he chose the third stanza for the Lass uns in deine Liebe, let us in your love, and so on. And interestingly enough, in the instrumental part, he takes this fragment of the last line of the chorale melody. And now in the opening measures of the strings, we have this ba ba ba, and again, and also then once again at the very end. So in other words, he receives his inspiration, so to say, for the instrumental part right from the chorale melody itself. And so what seems to be a composition that is just a composition for itself suddenly becomes, you know, a writing from a chorale. Well, I see with the clock there we've got a serious problem. See what I would like to point out. Tell me what you know in 3 minutes. You know. I think this would be sort of an important kind of a thing that I would want to point out. The use of the capo aria, you might take this sort of a thing for granted. When you think of this form, you perhaps just think in terms of any old text being repeated, and that there is not a very strong reason for the repetitions. And let me just get that out here for you here, because I think that would be worthy of your consideration. This is the second aria, and the middle aria of the cantata last evening. dying without fear and trembling. I point out that Lames, who is, of course, the mastermind behind this text, he was one who died at age 32. His remarkable feats in poetry and in text and cantata text writing and so on, they had such a positive note about them. And of course, if you know some of his some of the texts that Bach used, "Mein Herz schwimmt im Blut," you'll think, "Well, my word! I mean, that's really not quite positive." But you have to understand also even how that one is meant. This is not so astonishing. Or let's say strange, really, for its time. But when you see this particular text, the idea of if you are in faith, you have a reason to be glad, and it is not a flippant sort of a otherworldliness, but rather it is a positiveness that is founded on faith. It has to do with hope. And in the case of Lames, but also of Lichtenberg, you have the idea of hope, the Christian hope being used again and again. And this Christian hope would be related to the way you would find it in the book of Hebrews, the 11th chapter, that hope is the reality of the things that we can't see. It's the reality of the things that we can't see by faith, you know. So this is not sort of a lighthearted, flippant sort of a thing at all. Well, perhaps we could have another workshop sometime. I'll give you the other part of what I had there for this one, you know? Yes?
If people pick up in that movement the security of the voice against the trembling of the orchestra.
Yes.
It's very ceremonial.
And again and again, wherever I've sung this cantata, I remember that one of the most memorable times was when I sang it, was at the Confessio Augustana celebrations in Augsburg in 1980. And that was a rare time because I was especially flown in to sing these cantatas in a special concert for that occasion, and fly me all the way back to Seattle again for that. But it was this aria, that they felt that this was sort of a main reason why they wanted me to come and sing these cantatas, because they said, "All right, this somehow expresses what we are about here in this celebration," and so the suppleness on the one hand, but this bold, this confidence. I mean, it's enormous. The enormous confidence that is expressed here. And as you would have opportunity to have more contact with these cantatas, I think you would become sensitive to the kinds of care, the enormous care that went into these cantatas. I have personally examined many hundreds of these cantatas. I have not examined all 1,400. But you can go to Darmstadt, the court library. They are there in beautiful condition. But at any rate, of the hundreds that I've looked at, there is not one cantata that is somehow slipshoddy. It's not just tossed together. It's, from a craftsman point of view, first class. They're neat, and you can see there from these manuscripts, the facsimiles here, you can see that the handwriting is careful. It's not, you know, a lot of sort of sloppy mistakes. And he made one very interesting comment. Matison, the historian and composer who wrote about a lot of the composers of the time, he had a special respect for Graupner's manuscripts, you know, and his full scores. And he said, "This is, you know, they are like an etching." Of course, he also had people like Telemann in mind, where you really had to use your imagination to know what in the world he was writing, because the man was just writing. He would start out very clearly, and by the time he would get going, it was this one big smear. With Graupner, it was just, you know, it was so clearly written And so he was asked, well, why do you go to all that trouble? It's just for next Sunday, and probably nobody will ever do it again, and so on. Well, his answer was, the essence is this, I'd like to avoid all the problems in the rehearsals, all the mistakes and things that arise through sort of a fleeting sort of an approach to things. And then, and he said, and especially if the copyist is not musical. So he liked to make his full scores meticulously right, so that then when the copyist gets to the person who would copy out the parts, would get this manuscript in his hands, they would have no excuse for making mistakes. And then Grautner personally went through all the parts, wrote in all the cleft signs and the flat signs and sharp signs and so on, making sure that those parts were absolutely perfect. And it's really rare when you find a mistake somewhere in those manuscripts. So these were top grade professionals who were playing, but then every week they had to bring out a new one there. Well, yes. There's not a uniform practice everywhere, but you had people like Neumeister and others like Lehms and Lichtenberg, who wrote these cantata text yearbooks. And that would be one source of cantata texts for composers. And you could, at the time, you could perhaps purchase a Neumeister collection of texts of this sort and go off to your little church somewhere and compose cantatas to those texts. Now, the fact that Bach wrote far fewer cantatas but then struggled with these texts, that's, of course, quite a different story altogether. But also, Bach did not have a very close friend who was very close to him in faith and in literature and aesthetically and so on and so forth to work with, so to say, daily. I think this would have revealed really quite a different situation. And so because of Bach's situation, sometimes we've gotten the impression that all these composers were essentially writing their own cantata texts all the time, and this was far from the truth. With Grautner was quite different because he had the cantata text yearbook printed the year before. It was printed by the court, and so the royalty, when they were sitting there in the service on Sunday afternoon, they would have that textbook in front of them. So this would have been more than ironic if they would have been changed around and so on and so forth. But you see, with Grautner, he was able to work ahead of time together with the poet. And he did not have to submit, you know, two or three possibilities to the pastor, say, well, I wonder what you think, and so on. It was well taken care of ahead of time, and they got on quite well. And by the way, there are a number of comments in the cantata text that would really astonish you when you think that royalty is sitting in front of you. There's one from the 1750 cantata for bass on the third of Christmas. It says something, this absolutely rigorous aria, final aria of the cantata, it talks something about like the front, you can go ahead and be proud, you royalty, you know, with your pomptuousness, but my nobleman is above all of you. I mean, you think, is he trying to get into a fist fight here, you know? But evidently they wanted that. It was part of the sort of the homiletic side of things. They were trying to include that sort of thinking, to keep their thoughts straight before God. Wait a minute, we are not God. God is God. We are His servants on earth, you know. And absolutely astonishing. I just thoroughly enjoyed it. That Bach would be more profound theologically. I would even wouldn't say that I differ with you on that, but perhaps I do in that if you take complex, because you're also talking about Bach putting, so to say, all of his theology into fewer pieces. If you're only talking about the cantatas, of course, both composers compose a lot of other music. But whereas Graupner spread all of his theology over many hundreds of cantatas more, and then where he had dealt with the theology on this one-to-one basis with his text writers, I think you'd be really quite pleased with the and astonished at the amount of depth that is in the theological considerations there. I mean, it's really profound. It's really profound. Just simply, where you see this thing here with the three chorale melodies. I mean, that's my word. I mean, that is profound. That is profound. I'm sorry, you had a question. Well, in the case of Graupner, especially in his years after 1739, where he was indeed composing a cantata per week, he of course knew ahead of time, a year ahead of time, what he would be doing on a given Sunday. Whether he possibly gathered ideas over a period of time, I wouldn't be surprised. But he was known for working diligently into the wee hours, composing, getting the parts written out, usually by someone else, and then, as I told you, he would go through the parts, getting them to the musicians, I couldn't really say. I don't know. I mean, but the thing is that I think he indeed had the things done a little bit ahead of that, but because that would have really been, what happens if you get a black eye on Tuesday or something, you can't see the page to write on Wednesday or something, wouldn't have a cantata for the next week. But the idea here is, though, that Graupner had top-grade professional players and singers So he did not have to hammer the parts into anyone. And this is incredibly important. Also, there's a lot, he would, so to say, it was a situation where he could allow himself to write so many cantatas because the players and the singers could cope with it so readily. He wouldn't have to rehearse it like they would at St. Thomas in Leipzig and have all the struggles and the battles, you know, with the performers and so on. Then you have to realize that Bach wrote, Graupner wrote a lot, just very, very much chamber music that he really did treat as sort of well-crafted entertainment music for the court. And you know, he does not put the care into those pieces like he does the cantatas. It's strictly functional music, and like I say, it's by the pound, you know. And then he wrote Sinfonia for other occasions and with more instruments and other works. So every week he would have written, beside the cantata, a number of sort of incidental pieces. And of course, then by the time 1754 came along, his eyesight was really going out, and he lived until 1760. And those last years, then beyond that, it was a great frustration for him because he was blind by that time, and it was a great frustration because he had the cantatas in his head and he couldn't put them down on paper. It's But they said during that time he was an absolute, you know, picture of a Christian testimony in being nonetheless kind to those around him, just because he couldn't write down what he had in his mind and heart. Friends, we have a rehearsal that started 12 minutes ago.